Irene Tinker is Professor Emerita of Women's Studies and City and Regional Planning at the University of California at Berkeley. She is the founder of the Equity Policy Center, a research policy center that was one of the first to attend to the needs of women in international development. Professor Tinker is the author of many articles, and her books include Street Foods, Urban Food and Employment in Developing Countries, and Women's Rights to House and Land, China, Laos, Vietnam. Irene Tinker is in Champaign-Urbana to give a MillerCom address at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus of the University of Illinois. Her talk is titled Alternative Ways to Power. Irene Tinker, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Celeste. I appreciate being here.
Well, thank you for joining us. I think it would be useful to get some background here at the outset. Maybe you'd tell us about the Research Policy Center, EPOC, the Equity Policy Center.
It was a think tank that I set up in Washington, D.C. It was the third or fourth of these research centers I'd set up for different purposes. The first one was the Wellesley Center for the Research on Women, which was domestically oriented, and then the International Center for Research on Women, which was more internationally focused. And the idea in both of those cases is to do the research. But what I found out after I was a presidential appointment under President Carter was that once you're in the bureaucracy, even if you want to do something, it's sometimes hard to figure out how to make the bureaucracy work, just like the universities, actually. And so after I left the government, I decided that I would set up a center that would work with the bureaucracies to try to change some of the systems.
And when did the Equity Policy Center come into being?
1978.
And is it still going?
It is, but as I say, it's on sabbatical right
now. It's on sabbatical. Projects to date, what kinds of things has the center involved itself with?
Well, over time, the main thrust of the center was to look at what were the major policy issues of the day and try to see how women fit into them. In 1979, for example, the United Nations Conference on Science and Technology for Development took place. This happened to be a time when appropriate technology or the small is beautiful ideas were very much in currency. And the internationally focused people began to look at data that we had developed about women's work. I wrote an article, for example, saying the real rural energy crisis is women's time. And what we found is that women work incredibly long hours, especially at that time in subsistence agriculture. And much of their time is taken up by processing food or by fetching water or collecting firewood. Now, all of those things can have technical solutions. You can have cook stoves that actually consume less fuel. You can have grinders that cut down on the pounding of, say, rice or grain, or using a foot pedal as they do in Bangladesh. You can also, as many Peace Corps volunteers did, pipe water in with plastic pipes and produce water that is downtown instead of a couple of miles outside of town. So much of the focus on appropriate technology turned on women's work, but often the technologists did not think about the technology once it was used in the kitchen. So they would do such things as propose a cook stove where the women had to cut the firewood up into certain lengths in order to be able to shut the door. And in many cultures, the women didn't have anything to cut the wood with. So they would do the traditional system of putting the whole log in, which, of course, destroyed the total efficiency. So there were a lot of issues that had to be raised to remind the technicians that what worked in a lab did not necessarily work in the field.
I can remember my mother complaining in the kitchen, you know, who designed this kitchen? You know, how many steps do...
I tell you, in planning, we went through a lot of that. And the women in planning now look back and show how the men had this idealized concept of how women should behave in the suburbs. And it was dreadful for many women, sort of isolated and so on.
Yeah. So how did the Street Foods Project come to be?
Much of the focus in women and development showed that as countries became more monetized, as money became important instead of just growing food or exchanging food, the cash, the ability for cash jobs almost always went to the men. And they didn't always bring the money home. In fact, men tended to feel it was their money. For example, in Africa, there was a great emphasis on cash crops.
Mm-hmm.
But the men require the women to continue to work on the fields, whether they're the cash crop or the food crops. So the men were taking, perhaps having, say, coffee or pyrethrium on the major, on the better crop areas. Women would have to work on those areas. Then they would also work to grow subsistence food, which is their traditional role. The men would then use the cash income for themselves, and the women actually had less time to provide food for their children, which was the traditional food outcome. And in fact, the per capita food in Africa has been falling in the last 10 to 15 years, and it's not surprising because the women are overburdened while the men are using cash for other things. So the next question was, are there ways that women can earn some cash both for their daily living and for the new requirements of sending children to school, because school is not free in most of the developing countries.
And
so there were all these
type of business as well. You could
you
make
see
some
the
money, and you could, in the process of doing this business, you could provide food for your children.
Well, there were a lot of efforts to develop small programs and enterprises, most of which were not very successful. Women would teach knitting and sewing to women who were farmers, and they didn't know how to knit and sew. And you can imagine that products were not exactly exciting. Or if they were successful, as, say, in Nepal, where they developed a very nice woolen sweater industry, when one or two women's groups did it, it's fine. When 25 did it, the price went down, and they couldn't make any money. Well, these are the examples of things that weren't working. And so I decided it would be interesting to see what kind of traditional income activities women did. And all you need to do is look around in many countries and you see people selling food. And there had never been a study because it was dismissed as something that would disappear with modernization. Just look at New York City now, right?
Right.
And Wall Street. And so we actually developed a project model to study for over a year, the street foods, by looking at the vendor to find out if the vendor was male or female, to find out who made the food, to find out the extent of the family support system and how much money they made. We then looked at the customers and found out whether they varied by type of time of year and so on. And then finally, we looked at the health of the food, because the main arguments, as Giuliani, Mayor Giuliani did in New York, is to argue that the food is not safe. And so by looking at all of these aspects, and we did case studies ourselves and with other people, and eventually in 9 different countries, working with local researchers, most of whom were women, to, among other things, help them understand social science methodology, and then worked with the local municipalities all along so they knew what we were doing, we were able to show both how important the food was to feeding the people in that country, in that city, how important the total income was to the revenues, as high as 10 or 15% in some of these small places, and to look at the food safety factor, which was essentially, we found that the problem was access to clean water, to wash hands, and the utensils. People understood boiling water for eating, but the utensils and the plates were not clean. So if you're eating street foods, you eat them off a stick, a skewer,
eat them on a banana leaf,
mm-hmm.
you're fine. Just don't eat them with a spoon.
Street food, would we call it, is it fast food?
It's what I've called the fast food in the third world. Yeah. There are now McDonald's in places like Jakarta, but the people who can afford those are middle class. So that the people who eat on the street want a fast and usually nutritious enough food, and also often more traditional food, can get it easily on the street. And one of the things is interesting is the variation among the countries we study as to the extent to whether women or men do this. For example, in Nigeria, something like 96% of everyone selling food is women. And people eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the street. It's just incredible. Whereas you get to a country like Bangladesh, where almost all the vendors are men because it's a fairly traditional Islamic area, but over a third of the total vendors worked with their wives to produce the food and sell it. So that, in fact, it was a very important family activity. Whereas again, in Africa, it was very much a male activity or a female activity. And so this reflects the cultures, it reflects the household responsibilities, and it, what we found all places is that most of the vendors made more money than certainly the equivalent of minimum wage, which is usually not paid, and some of them made a great deal more than even the lower level bureaucrats.
So it also then, one would assume it is a significant contribution to the economies.
Absolutely.
Of developing countries.
In Bogor, which is in Indonesia, we found that one out of every 14 people in the city had some relationship to working on street vending. And the result of this is the Food and Agriculture Organization, this big UN agency, which had taken the lead in trying to limit street foods on the grounds that they were not safe to eat, realized that they were never going to get rid of them, that this was much too big and a service and an income-producing activity, that they turned completely around and started training the vendors all around the world. And they have now a series of studies about how they went into these countries and how they tried to show safety measures.
Mm-hmm.
And in most of the countries, except in the major capitals, the local administration is now very accepting of having street foods. There's still this kind of sense that it's not modern to have street vendors in the middle of modern towns. But the answer to that is not to try to clear them out, but to provide spaces for them around the corners where they can have clean water. You do have to drive through some of these cities, and you don't want to have vending carts and everything all over, but you also want to have them available. And it would be like in our country saying that all McDonald's had to be 3 miles out of town. I mean, nobody mm-hmm. would stand for that. Well, the same thing happens as it tried with Giuliani. He wanted to get them out of the major areas. And for one time, the people in New York City said, no, we want them where they are, and we like the food.
The issue of water, as you mentioned a little while ago, is really critical. And with governments and non-government agencies now realizing, thanks to your research, the importance of street food, one wonders if that has also made a difference in the availability and the quality of water, if there has been, what kind of efforts have been made to get clean water to people.
Well, water is, in some people's minds, the really major problem in the world, that we're going to run out of water before we run out of arable land for growing food in the whole world. I mean, you hardly need to look at the paper without seeing fights between the Israelis and the Arabs about water, between the Sudanese and the Egyptians. I mean, you name it, we've got water problems. You're talking about urban water supply. The statistics show that only, I think, about a quarter of the total population in developing countries has access to clean water to begin with. And that would be primarily in the cities and primarily probably in the developed parts of those cities as opposed to the squatter areas. What has happened with regard to street foods is in the more progressive areas, they have set up spigots in the markets or in certain streets where the vendors can go and get clean water. In some of the countries, they require the vendors to carry clean water, sort of like containers of clean water, with them on their carts, which of course is difficult because it's heavy. Mm-hmm. And almost all the places do now have an oversight for the water side of cleanliness. But supplying clean water to the squatter areas and so on is a major urban problem and continues to be.
You looked at the Philippines, Thailand, Bangladesh, Egypt, Senegal, and Nigeria.
Indonesia.
Country to country, I'm sure the foods vary.
Oh, yes.
What other kinds of differences are there country to country?
Well, if you glanced at the book, this is put out by Oxford University Press, but the readers were so intrigued with the variety of food that we actually got them to put recipes in. Did you see that?
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
And we tested the recipes. My research assistants all ate them, and they are the very typical ones. But what I was saying is the variety is incredible. I mean, depending how you divide them, there were sort of 200-300 different varieties. It's sort of like if you count every variety of ice cream, you know, you'd end up more than if you put them all together. But the varieties of basic foods were incredible. What we found is that many of the traditional foods that take a lot of preparation time, cassava-based sort of gruel in Africa, mm-hmm. which has to be pounded and is people don't make it at home anymore. They buy it all from street foods. The same thing with a basic couscous in Senegal. Moni was, again, very time-consuming, so you are likely to find that. What we found in the Asian countries is, like with Chinese food, people don't consider one dish a dinner. So you have to have four or five, and you can easily get that at a street vendor. If you cook it at home, it's a lot of work. And we found that many people are either, especially the poor, are working so hard, or perhaps they are men with their wives somewhere else mm-hmm. in the villages, or they are women who are also vendors. They buy street foods as well, and even the upper class buy them. And one of the funniest things was one time I was visiting a very wealthy woman in Thailand, and she invited me home for dinner. And she apologized and said that their servants were from the Northeast, and they really were such bad cooks that she and her family always stopped by and brought home one of these tiffin boxes, you know, the round little plates that mm-hmm. have about four or five stacked up. And that each member of the family had different preferences, and they would come home with two or three of these stacks and put the food into a plastic container, heat it up in the microwave, and eat it. This was a family driving only Mercedes-Benz cars.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just pervasive.
I heard a really interesting report on All Things Considered on National Public Radio some months back about food vendors in India offering delivery service so that they would take these boxes of lunches and dinners and bicycle them.
That's a bit of an age-old trend, especially around Bombay, which until recently was one of the major, certainly the major commercial city in India. India is an odd place because more than anywhere else, there are restrictions on foods that you can eat outside of the house. And when you add the caste restrictions, you have to be pretty poor or pretty modern to eat out in India. So the result is that when you had all these low-level clerks working in downtown Bombay, they would have to eat food that was of their own caste. Well, the women would get up in the morning and cook the food, And they couldn't get up and get the food quick enough for the men to get on the trains to take the trains into Bombay. So they had this elaborate system in which the women would make the food, put a tag on it, take it to the train station, or sometimes even people would pick it up. Then these coolies would take it into town, deliver it to the guy, pick it up and take it home so she could wash it and have it ready for the next day before the man even got home. And to see them going on these long poles, you know, over their shoulder and balancing piles of these tiffin boxes, as they call it, is incredible. And it just still is an indication of the how little interchange there is in caste or religious persuasion in India, so that people, especially of the lower classes, will not eat in a public place.
Mm. Fascinating. Irene Tinker is our guest this afternoon. She's Professor Emerita of Women's Studies and City and Regional Planning at the University of California at Berkeley. She is in Champaign-Urbana to give a Millercom address tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. Levis is located on the campus of the University of Illinois at 919 West Illinois Street in Urbana. And her talk is titled Alternative Ways to Power. Irene Tinker is the founder of the Equity Policy Center, a research policy center that was one of the first to attend to the needs of women in international development. Her books include Street Foods, Urban Food, and Employment in Developing Countries, and Women's Rights to House and Land, China, Laos, Vietnam. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the discussion, your questions are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about what it is like to be in this business, somewhere far away from where we are sitting. What's a day like for a woman with a food business, say, in Senegal? What's her day like?
Well, all right, you picked Senegal. Senegal, this area that we studied in the city is Casamance. We only looked at provincial towns because we felt that they were more typical than the very modernizing capitals. In Casamance, as in much of Senegal, a majority of families are polygamous. We found that it was frequently the oldest woman who would be the street vendor, and that the younger women would stay home and take care of each other's children and often continue to the farming, because this was a very relatively remote area where farming was still important. We further found that the elderly women not only tended to support the family and the husband of all these various wives, often the man himself might be unemployed because it was a very poor area and it was a downturn in economics and not many jobs, and often the men didn't farm, so they just sat around and let the women do the work. The women would also often save some of the money, because under Islamic law it's relatively easy to be divorced. And so being the street vendors, they not only, sometimes they worked with their husbands, but in more cases we found that they were ensuring their future sort of pensions if for some reason the husband disappeared. But the cooperation among the women in the family was very interesting. I think the family size average was over 9 people, in which there'd be 2 or 3 adults and then a bunch of children. The women in those cases, as we found everywhere else, tended to make less money than the men who were also selling in street foods. But one of the reasons is the women, like in this country, have more than one job. They not only make, process, and sell the street foods, then they go home and help the housework or with taking care of the farm or something. We found that the per hour spent, women actually made more money than men. So it's an interesting balance. But the foods tended to be very different in terms of what was acceptable. The men, at least in this part of Senegal, were primarily from a former nomadic tribe. And so the young men, in order to get money for bride price to buy a wife, would come into the city utilizing the cattle and sell beef kebabs. And so only the men sold it, and only the men from that particular tribe essentially could do that. And it was sort of a way of, again, getting your down payment to get a wife, and then you would go, presumably, and become a nomad again. The women of that tribe also made and sold yogurt. So again, you had this kind of interesting specialization of the tribal group as well as of male and female.
Do children play a role in food vending businesses? Let's take Senegal, for instance.
In all of these countries, and I recall that the people with the energy and imagination to sell in street foods are usually very ambitious compared to many of their other peers. Almost all of them were trying very hard to have at least the boys, if not boys and girls, in school, because they saw that as a way of avoiding having to do all of these hard work and the farms and so on. And we found that the more women who were vendors, the more they were sending the girls to school too, which is, I think, an indication that they also understood the importance of schooling for the girls. In Senegal, after we did our study, there unfortunately erupted a civil war. It was the only town I did not go back to when I wrote the book, because one of the ideas was to go back 5 or so years after we finished the project to see what the long-term impact was of the various recommendations and work that we had done. So in that particular case, I did not go back to the Civil War area. I'm not even sure I could have gotten there. Mm-hmm. But what I did do is then to do a review of what was going on in the capital, Dakar. And in that particular case, we learned that the schools in Casamance had pretty well fallen apart. So presumably, many of the ideas and efforts of the vendors that we had talked to had been dashed by the Civil War.
Elsewhere in the world where you looked at food vendors, how were the burdens of work split up if a man and a woman were involved in a food business?
Well, take the Philippines, for example. The Philippines is and most of the Southeast Asian countries have a very strong history of support for women as well as men. And in the Philippines in particular, the men have tended, at least in where they can, to be in the government or the bureaucracy or military, because these are status jobs. The women have been the entrepreneurs. Just like in Thailand, you find the women running the hotels, for example. And so in the Philippines, what we found is that when a woman began to be very successful in her street vending, the man who might have a low-level government job might quit and join her. And although you saw them as a couple, it was always the woman running the shop and the man doing other things. They would invest, for example, in a truck and go to the countryside and bring in the raw materials, which then, of course, cut the costs of making the foods and then increased their income. So you often saw the couples working together. And in the Philippines, unlike Islamic countries, even though there may be mistresses and so forth, they do not divorce. And so it's a stable, at least, relationship of the men and the women working together.
Professor, if you'd put on your headphones,
yes.
We're going to talk with a caller.
Good.
On line one, a caller in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Do you have some recipes? Are you going to put out a recipe book?
Well, I tell you, I found there had been a recipe book put out by a woman called Street Foods, and we actually took one of the recipes from her book. Most of the others were ones that we collected in the country. I'm afraid I don't have them in front of me, but you can purchase the book, or perhaps you can ask the station to fax you a few of them.
Sounds good to me. The question I have really is one of macro and microeconomics.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the World Bank is always following up countries like this. What impact does that have, or does that require the street economy, the shadow economy?
Well, I wouldn't call it shadow. I mean,
one
of the things that's interesting is that it was assumed that all of these vendors were operating illegally. And in fact, almost all of them had various kinds of permits. Most of them didn't have all of the permits. Often they had to have one from the health department and the police and maybe someone else. But they almost all had some kind of permits, so they weren't illegal in that sense.
Yeah.
But what is important about the street foods is this is a traditional effort. They understood that you don't borrow very much money because if you get sick or have problems selling your food, you have no way of repaying anything. So what the real UN agencies that were involved with street vending have been primarily the Food and Agriculture Organization. And they have really been increasingly supportive of helping these vendors sell safe food, but learn how to sell, supporting the idea that they need to sell. Now, the World Bank has been very instrumental in supporting microenterprise, especially for women, and helping to support these small-scale loans that are often referred to as, say, the Grameen Bank model. And they are promoting non-governmental organizations to make these loans available. And some of the loans are used for vendors. But we found the vendors are very canny about not getting into debt.
Yeah.
And that one of the major problems, besides government harassment of the vendors, was that if the main vendors got sick, they never had any health insurance, and they would often spend all of their available income and money in getting well again, and then they'd have to start. And it was interesting in several countries where the vendors organized, partly under the impetus of our study, one of the first things they wanted is some kind of reasonable health insurance. Sounds familiar, right?
Well, that's probably one of the biggest needs that we have worldwide.
Absolutely.
And we haven't solved the problem here yet. What about vertical integration? Sounds like you've some of the family units start out with raw materials and go to finished products. How dependent are these enterprises on other sources of materials for their enterprise?
Very good question. We looked at the various sources of food. For example, in Bangladesh, women in their houses would make a kind of munchies that were very good. They would then sell them to street vendors, or they would sell them to shops in Dhaka, where they were sold like potato chips. And we tried to trace some of these sort of backward linkages. The study was set up to focus on the vendor and the people to whom they were selling. The other thing that we found is that there was an incredible amount of catered food, just like here. And you walk into large business building, there would be in the basement someone who would turn up food and have it on your desk if you ordered it. And these we didn't trace because they didn't have anyone on the street. But they were clearly of the same kind of activity. And one of the things that happens in all of this is it's very clear we know very, very little about the real ways that people feed themselves in cities in third world countries, and I'm not sure we know that much about what's going on now.
But And any disruption in the supply chain can disrupt the microeconomy then. And if you don't control your own resources and you're dependent on somebody else, and there's a civil war, or if there's a flood, or if there's a drought, you have troubles.
The level of most of the microenterprise street vendors that we're talking about is that they need access to the raw food and vegetables.
Sure.
And obviously, if there's a flood, they are in trouble. Most of these poor families have more than one source of income, mm-hmm. although the street vending might be the major source. But the other thing, it's also true that as these vendors got into the larger towns, they often, for example, with ice cream, very few vendors made their own. They actually became commission sellers. And also now with bread, it became extremely popular, and these were also sold from carts. And we found, we were trying in Indonesia to improve the value of the food by adding soybeans. As local women researchers there decided that would enhance the nutritive value of some small cookies if we could add this extra bean. And the bean was being imported at a subsidized price from the United States, and they stopped it. And, of course, the whole thing fell apart. So, yes, there are some elements of the world food globalization of food that affect street foods. On the whole, you're ducking below that.
Well, thank you for your insights, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I hope you enjoy trying a few of the recipes.
Yeah, you know what? I came into the studio this afternoon without the book, and Jason Croft, our director, is going to go and retrieve it from my desk. So maybe before our time is out, we'll share one of the recipes from the book. Some developing countries have seen relatively rapid economic growth. How has that affected people who sell street food and their customers?
We tried to draw comparisons between the level of modernization and the number of street vendors. Once you get increasing traffic jams, which you're getting in more countries, people increasingly are eating out where they work, just like they are in our country. So in many respects, the rapid modernization has encouraged the number of vendors, just like in this country, families with the women and men working are eating more fast foods. So that in many respects, this has helped the development of street foods. We found in Nigeria where when there was a downturn in the economy, the middle class, who had been sort of starting to go to more typical restaurants or more formal restaurants, were going back to street foods because it was a much better buy. So again, the variations matter, but so does the culture. I mean, some cultures are much more accepting of eating out than others.
Some years back, 1993, at the World Conference on Human Rights, women's rights were declared to be human rights. Has that declaration had an impact on women in developing countries?
It's probably had, in my mind, the most incredible impact of any movement in the recent period of time since the women's movement started, because what we've been talking about are economic opportunities for women in the public sector. But women in many countries, and I mentioned in Senegal, the women are bought and sold, and in many Islamic countries, easily divorced. The women are the ones who still take care of the children, and often they are out of the house and out of any support from the husbands. But if they are staying in the house, there's also the problem of domestic violence. And it's clear in this country as well as elsewhere, when you have strains on with rapid change, when men lose their jobs, when families begin to fall apart, there's almost always an increase in domestic violence. And as again, in this country until recently, women could be beaten up and there was relatively little follow-up. Now, with this declaration, what women's rights are human rights, it's saying that civil law applies within the family. And therefore, if the men kill the woman, they should be, notice should be, subject to civil law. Well, I was looking on the internet just before I came here, and there was a case in Pakistan where a woman wanted to divorce a man who'd been beating her up for all of these many years. And she took out divorce proceedings. She was an educated woman. She went to a lawyer. And her own family was so disgusted with her that they hired a killer who actually followed her to her lawyer's office and shot her. And there was then introduced into the parliament in, I'm talking like April of this year, into the parliament in Pakistan, a law saying that these crimes could no longer be protected, and the law was not passed. And the email account noted that there were 286 honor killings of women in the last year in Pakistan. So even killing a wife is not considered a crime in many of these countries. But now the various Convention on the Elimination of All Discrimination Against Women, which is part of the Civil Rights Commission of the United Nations, is at least in place to accept complaints from countries about the violation of women's rights. The fact that I can tell you that this happened and it came over email this quickly is an indication of the kind of information sharing that is inevitably going to put pressure on countries like Pakistan to change their laws. Another thing that is changing and not changing is women's rights to having a house. If women are divorced or the men disappear, in many cases it's the woman who is out of the house with the children. And we figure if the women are taking care of the kids, they ought to have the house. Well, there's again a case that's going on right now in Zimbabwe. In 1982, when that country became independent, they passed a law making men and women essentially equal. Last June, the Zimbabwe Supreme Court decided that they had misinterpreted that law and that customary law, which gave men the rights to the land, should have taken precedence over the equal rights that were given in the new constitution. And therefore, customary law is now back in Zimbabwe, and the woman in this particular case lost her house. And this is going on. We did this study recently, the book that is just out, looking at what was happening in the rapidly changing countries that were formerly communist, that is China, Laos, and Vietnam, where women and men were equal, and where the laws being put in place now do guarantee equality if the women sign up. And we found the women didn't understand that it was very wise if they signed on pieces of paper that said they were equal owners of houses or land, because it hasn't been a problem yet. But the reassertion of sort of patriarchal rights that come from these traditional societies is happening again. We are trying to encourage the women to keep the rights they have and not lose them.
Mm. We're out of time. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you this afternoon. And we'll do the recipes later this afternoon on this program, because we've got to move along to another element of the program this afternoon. Irene Tinker, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. She is going to be giving a MillerCom address tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. And Levis is located, if you're unfamiliar, on the campus of the University of Illinois at 919 West Illinois Street in Urbana. Her talk is titled Alternative Ways to Power. Irene Tinker is Professor Emerita of Women's Studies and City and Regional Planning at the University of California at Berkeley. Her books include Street Foods, Urban Food, and Employment in Developing Countries, and the book that we just touched on talking about here at the end of this segment of the program, Women's Rights to House and Land, China, Laos, and Vietnam.